Roll another.
Hey, and welcome back to Extra Features Podcast. Today we have a fabulous director named Simon Devani. Devani Simon, whatever way he would like to say it. He's a writer, director, producer. His film, Maturing Youth, is a coming-of-age story. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So where did this idea come from? Was this a personal experience?
Personal in the way that I was merely looking at my life and wasn't fairly accustomed to the direction it was heading toward. The idea pretty much manifested, yes, correct, from within me, but not everything you see is 100% accurate of what happened in my life. I really wanted to tell a story more about accepting responsibility, and I masked that through responsibility of fatherhood.
Which I thought was great. I guess my main question is this film going to schools or high schools or church groups or what's your plan for it?
Right now we're in the New York film festival circuit, and then afterwards we will be going to L.A. And then after L.A., who knows, you may go international, but it really depends on how successful the film is doing as of after the film festivals. Right now on October 21st. We have been accepted into Cutting Room International Short Film Festival, and we have been nominated for 6 awards, and, you know, Best Actor, Best Actress, Supporting, Film, Director, and that will be Film Block J, which I believe 7 o'clock p.m.
So I guess you start off your film, before we really even know anybody, you have very happy music, so your main lead is happy.
Correct.
He's having a good time. I even made notes that he's promoting drug culture, which is fine. I have no issues with that. And he's having a good time at the party, you know, and then he's watching kids programs, and then he's, you know, looking for his next fix. He invites a bunch of girls in, which is great. And then his world kind of falls apart quickly.
Yeah, that's pretty much right on the nail. Yeah, correct. I agree.
Okay. So far we're doing good. Like, so is that what you want? Just have a sense of reality immediately? I thought we maybe get a little bit more sense of his life. Or you think it's just because it's a short film, we don't have time for that?
Well, I agree with you due to the fact that it's a short film. We don't have exactly as much time to really delve into as much of his backstory or the backstories of the secondary characters and whatnot. So really with the time I had allotted, I had to really cram as much information into so the audience could not only get accustomed to Roger, the main character, but also understand where he's coming from. And really what I wanted to do, yes, like as you previously mentioned, you know, he's happy where he is in his life. He's pretty much, content with where he is. He doesn't really want to, advance. He's totally fine with squandering at his mother's home, you know, using her for money that, you know, he sent checks every once in a while. He's also on getting unemployment checks, so he's absolutely fine. And I really wanted the audience to kind of, like, hate him at first, to dislike him or hate him, depending on the viewer. Because I've always felt that, you know, it's a lot easier to grow to love someone, but then it is to dislike them first, then to get to know them and at least see that they're trying in their life and you see them, you know, transforming, which allows you to actually like them toward the end.
Yeah, I want to know about your dialogue when you're writing it. I found the two black women that show up to party with him, I found their dialogue very raw. Or did you write it that way?
Well, there were times while I was writing the dialogue, actually I wrote the whole screenplay, I think within 2 weeks, and it was at my backyard. So yeah, there was times where I really wanted to just get the raw feeling of, it feels like you're actually, it's not anything that's been practiced too much, because I know the difference between real dialogue and, for example, dialogue if we're thinking about, like, watching a film back in 1956, you know, how the golden age of Hollywood, if you will, you know. So I wanted to make sure that I nailed that real feeling that is really just like two simple people talking. And then as we're progressing throughout the film, for example, the doctor scene with Dr. Ricard, he's speaking more profound, you know, with a much higher vocabulary, I felt. But yeah, that's why I really want Roger to relate everyone as an everyday man, you know. And I wouldn't call him a gentleman, but he's very relatable in the way he speaks, and especially relatable to the stoner subculture of today's society.
Oh, I gotta say, the doctor, I would say, is a gentleman. He kind of gives him, hey, this is your life. This is the two options you got.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah, it's up to Roger to make a choice.
Yeah, yeah. A lot of people have been asking me what this Dr. Ricard represents. You know, does he represent some type of like an otherworldly figure, which I do lean more, you know, towards as far as him being otherworldly, as opposed to him really being a part of Roger's subconscious. It's more, the Dr. Ricard is more, I saw as I was writing him, an otherworldly figure. And just as he said in the film, he really mani-moles around the world, helping people realize their where they are in their life and how to improve it. He doesn't really force anything upon you. He gives you really merely a choice, which is a lot more than a lot of people have been, you know, allotted. So I remember Terrence Keane, he plays on Dr. Ricard. He actually saw him more as I can remember, I think he was saying that either like a subconscious figure or whatnot. I personally saw him more of like a godlike figure. That's why I remember giving him feedback on his character, because with Dr. Ricard, he didn't really have that much background. It's more of his character was really there for as the representation, just the same as the females that were introduced in the story, apart from Sadie. So, yeah, they're characters that have backgrounds, and then these characters really are there for representation.
I think you have to take the doctor as an angel figure, I wrote down as, because Roger comes in after smoking. He even states that when the doctor was, doctor, you finally got here. I was just outside smoking, and this happened to my kid. So I thought maybe he was still in a drug-induced haze.
Yeah, and that's what I really want. I wanted the feeling of that scene to be almost ambiguous as for the viewer, so that they can really feel, they can choose what that means for them. And so I didn't want to have him at, you know, nailed in the ground as a actual man that we, that has background references. Because when you think about it, and what has been mentioned before from a reviewer has said that you don't really see, you know, doctors make house calls anymore. So that's one of the elements I wanted to input into the script that made it feel as if it's not what you're watching. Is it really doesn't feel too natural? Because if this is natural, he would just take his son to the hospital. But for a person to just stop by and visit, yeah, you can say it's drug induced or it's meant to be, or is a eternal lesson. And it's really up to the viewers. I want it to be ambiguous.
I think it was great. I liked that a lot. I also want to add the weed sweater was a very nice touch.
Yeah, thank you.
I want to know where you got a weed sweater.
The website was called webundies.com. And before I even really looked up, I wanted Roger to stand out in the entire film. Because, you know, we had clothing options, but I feel like the way how the cinematography was, as far as the hue of the film, as far as the color grading, it could make him, if he just wore, for example, regular clothes throughout the entire film, he can just pretty much blend in. I didn't want him to blend in. I want him to pop out. I want each time you see him on screen, you can't help but look at him because of the vibrance of the of the robe, of the Rastafarian robe. And why I picked that, the biggest reason why I picked it is because of the marijuana symbol on the back of the robe, because I wanted that to really keep on reminding that as long as he keeps on, you know, wearing that robe, he's within that mindset of a stoner, of a who doesn't choose to grow. And of course, a nice touch, I thought that it does honor my Jamaican heritage, so That was really 2-for-1 with that package.
Well, there you go. See, that's where you gotta ask these questions. You gotta get that real answer.
Yeah.
You really try to hammer us on Roger being a bad dad, I find. Beer, drug use, and he's constantly with the kid, and he's just not doing anything. So, I mean, I did think he really hit that home to hammer that in for us.
Well, I feel like I'm going to leave that entirely within the lap of the viewer. Personally, while writing it, I related more to him at that time in my life, more than I do now. Even while after filming and even filming, during the production and after the production, I transformed, you know, my person just the same as Roger did. But as far as him wanting, as far as the audience, you know, seeing him as a bad guy, I kind of saw him more as like, well, if you watch the Coen brothers' Big Lebowski and you see the dude as, you know, as if you hate him, then that's a different thing. But, I mean, I feel like the times that you would really hate Roger is not really for the drug abuse or the rambunctiousness of his personality. It's more of him being so against accepting the role of fatherhood that he just, for example, there's one scene where the kid, you know, where his illegitimate son, you know, sits with him next on the couch and he takes him up, puts him on the ground, and he lays down the couch so the kid doesn't have to sit next to him. That's just, I wanted that to be more about the visual statement as to how he feels in that position. And I can understand definitely why the viewer doesn't necessarily like the character, the main character, Roger. But I wanted it more so because of the fact that he is really, he's almost like a deadbeat, you know. He doesn't really care about being a father. He's comfortable where he is. I wanted that to be more of the reason as opposed to him just being a stoner, you know.
Oh, I'm with you. Because, I mean, Roger, I wrote notes, Roger has everything. He has money. He has a house. He has the ability to take care of this kid. And it's his kid.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree entirely.
I agree with it.
No, you can continue.
I just also want to say, I mean, he does nothing for his kid at the beginning. He doesn't even build him a bed.
Yeah, yeah, that was another visual statement I wanted to have that in this screenplay. The fact that I believe Sadie introduces the bed that she, you know, during a kitchen scene when they were arguing the back and forth, she says, I ordered a bed from a friend or whatnot, and it's coming. I need you to build it for him. And the fact that he really procrastinates the majority of the film just to build it, that was also another visual statement as far as where his mentality was at the time. You know, the fact that he kept on procrastinating, doesn't want to build it, and, you know, he's not even rushing to build it. He even picks up the instructions to learn how to build a bed, but he puts it down to go back and watch TV. So that's... And when he actually eventually does build the bed, you know, that does show where, you know, his mentality has transformed by the end.
Well, we haven't talked about Sadie, Al, and I think we would not do the film justice if we didn't mention Sadie at all.
Of course.
Okay. You gave me a quick backstory for Sadie. See, she's been homeless for a year.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted a little bit more information on that as a viewer. I was like, so what has she been doing with her kid and herself for a year? And then she reverts saying, well, I have a friend. So I'm like, was she staying with a friend occasionally, or?
Well, with Sadie, I mean, there was originally more backstory with Sadie in the screenplay. Actually, to tell you the truth, the screenplay, the original draft was 47 pages, I believe. And that's what you're thinking about, like a short film that's, you know, huge.
Yes.
So we did a lot within those 2.5 days. So we had to, in post, we had to really cut out a lot of content that didn't really necessarily advance the film. You know, so with Sadie, she was homeless for a year. She was more of, I remember writing in the script as far as her talking in that kitchen scene that we had to cut that part out because it was getting a little bit too lengthy. She said to Roger that she was really backpacking really to get away. To really, you know, to travel America, to like backpack across America and really just take in the sights and see all that. So yeah, I believe that she's been doing that for, you know, like she said, a year. So, but before that, she had her son and all that. And Supreme, I feel like her really getting out there to really soak in the sights of America is a way of her to really treat herself as a reward of freedom, because, you know, she has a kid, she's a single mother. And when she gets there and, you know, she does what she does, and then, you know, which leads, I don't want to really spoil too much for the viewers, but, you know, when she does what she does, and then we have Roger and we have, you know, his son Junior there, it's, and when she disappears, we can really assume that she leaves more because of, to be free. And she, I feel like she's definitely deserved that, at least if not for a while, because, you know, she had to raise a kid for several years. But before that, yeah, she definitely made a lot of friends around. I mean, if you're backpacking around America, there's a big chance they can make friends. So, yeah, I mean, that's our backstory. Apart from that, maybe she was a musician. I believe so. I would say she was a musician as far as the edginess of her style and her and their personality.
Okay, so we've gone through the film. Now, here's a big question. You're a, I don't know if you're a first-time director, but, I mean, this is a short film. Where did you find your actors?
Well, actually, I am. This is my first film, first thing I've ever written and directed, written and directed. As far as the actors, we held up auditions. I believe Chase, our producer, he put up a lot of ads up on, you know, Backstage and a lot of other programs I'm probably sure I'm not aware about, but we found the actors. They are all based near or in Manhattan. For example, the lead, Sean A. Kaufman, he was from Staten Island, so not too far out. So when we had our, you know, our casting calls, went through many people. Actually, Chase taught me a lot as far as selecting actors, and, you know, I'm going to be using in the future, but that was just a side note. And then when we found the actors, I felt, honestly, when I saw Sean, I just knew right away as far as his performance that he would be a great fit. All he really needed to do at that time was to really grow a beard, and he did that pretty, I would say pretty well if you look at the film. He did it pretty fast. And everyone else, everyone really gave terrific performances. And I believe there was just more than just one audition. And afterwards, you know, we have selected the actors and actresses. And then we had our rehearsals. And during the rehearsals is when I really enjoyed, because that I took pleasure in really refining the performances of the actors and actresses and really giving them backstory that, sure, the audience may not know, but is important, I feel, to give a backstory to a performer so that they can really present the way they act. For example, we may not know that this person is a drug addict, but if, you know, certain actions can give that tell away, you know?
So you got your actors, you're ready to go. How'd you find your location?
The location of shooting, I'm living in it right now. That's actually my home.
Oh, there you go. That was cheap for you.
Yeah.
So how did your neighbors feel about you shooting a film?
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
How did your neighbors feel about you shooting a film? I mean, I don't know how long it took you to shoot this, but, I mean, there's people coming in and out, you're doing outside shots.
How do we make the film?
No, your neighbors. Were they happy with you shooting a film? Were they involved?
Yeah, the neighbors. I'm actually very fortunate. The neighbor, you know, we let them know. I let them know weeks in advance. I let them know that we're shooting a film. There were times that I live on the corner of my block, so we have, like, you know, a main road going by, and a lot of people kind of slow down to see what was happening, because, you know, we were shooting some scenes right out in the front lawn and all that. And sometimes we just have to wait for them to pass by, and, you know. And the biggest issue with that was just really the sound department, because of the, you know, the engines really going back and forth. But the neighbors were really fine. Neighbors, not one complaint. We weren't even really too loud. It wasn't really as bad as I was expecting it to be as far as the reactions. So, yeah, I was blessed in that way.
Well, that's good to hear. I always want to ask, how'd you do your fundraising?
Fundraising? I really just by working. I took up a lot of jobs. I went through about 20 jobs, side jobs, just really raise up the money. My grandmother did invest, I believe, what, $2,000, so that was a big help. But I believe that the total budget, I mean, the budget of the film was $5,000 just to get every, you know, the equipment and all that. But then the all the other projected costs were about $30,000 and up. So I really had to really put, you know, I had to put my money where my mouth was, you know, like, and really go out there and work every day, sometimes a weekend, sometimes 7 days a week, just to really raise the funds, you know what I mean? Hopefully in the future that can change where people can see my vision better. But, yeah, the first one, had it was a lot of hard work that really went into it for, on my side.
So did you feed your crew from your own house then, since you're at home? You probably could just make food in your kitchen.
Well, at the time, we actually did, my family did own a restaurant at the time, but then my grandmother had to retire because she's getting up there in the years. So, you know, we got a lot, it's pretty 50-50. We got food from our restaurant, which was formerly known as Golden Crust. And then, you know, we also went, you know, we got some catering, Chinese food or whatever it was. And, but the, we definitely had almost actually a lot more food than people were willing to eat.
Wow.
They were stuffed. We definitely got them a lot of food. So food, you know, as long as you feed your crew, that's one of the elements of making sure everybody's happy on set. So, you know, I believe that we succeed in that way.
So being a first-time filmmaker, what did you learn?
Really, anytime anybody asks me that question, I really tell them that I learned by... Actually, learn is a joke. I actually tell them I did the Quentin Tarantino school of filmmaking, meaning that I just really watched and I studied a whole lot of films dating back from silent films, 1920s, all the way up, or sometimes 1910s, all the way up to current day. I personally feel like the best age of Hollywood or just of filmmaking was 70s. You know, 70s, especially after the 60s when the whole hippie phase ended and all that. I think the best political time of, as far as America was the 60s. But I learned a lot during that I learned a lot as far as culture of many different aspects, many different act performances. And I love watching, actually I love watching French films, and I learned a lot from a lot of amazing filmmakers. I have to tip my hat off to Akira Kurosawa. You know, I have to tip my hat off to Spike Lee, Coen Brothers, and many others. That actually, I have a book written. Anytime I watch a film that really blows my mind, I write it down in the book, and I make sure I write down what it's about, the actors, the director, the writer. And I really make sure to study the way the cinematography of a film, because as far as me going to film school, hopefully I'll be able to do that in the future, but financially I couldn't exactly do it during that time, and I had to really raise up the film because I didn't want to wait, you know? I just wanted to do a film. I mean, during that time we did the film, that was like, what, 2017? Now it's 2018. We live in the age of the internet, you know? So it's... All you have, if you want to make a film, all you gotta do is just pick up your phone and you can do it. Just the same as, I believe that film Tangerine, that great indie film Tangerine did on the iPhone. So if you want to do it, just do it. Don't just wait to get permission, you know? I mean, that's really the initiative I kind of took. And Kevin Smith was actually a great, the writer director Kevin Smith, he was actually a great proponent in speaking that way as far as his film Clerks back in the 90s. You know, like, he was one of the first filmmakers to really prove to the general mass population that anybody can do a film. Just pick up a camcorder and just do it, you know. So that's really what I did. I mean, later in the future, hopefully I can, you know, have time to go do film school. But until then, I'm just going to try to really do it. And even if I have to fail, I'll fail as long as I'm doing it. I'm actually productive, you know what I mean?
Two more questions for you. Do you have a book inside you?
Book, what do you mean by that?
Well, you're writing down films, you're writing insight, and I thought maybe you'd be writing some film analysis or something.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind doing that. I actually love writing. I'm actually right now currently writing A feature film that's set in 1968 deals with the Black Panther Party and the COINTELPRO program of the FBI. I'm also writing a short film right now, almost done. But yeah, that's in my plans to write a novel, a fiction novel, and also a film analysis, depending if people want to hear from me. Yeah.
I'd love to. I'm just announcing those directors in the film we were watching. I 100% agree with what you're saying. I do love the 70s. I think filmmaking really evolved during that period in Hollywood.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Well, that's all the questions I have for you, but I have fun questions if you're ready for them.
All right.
Because now I had some written down, but I'm changing them because of your answers. What's your favorite film?
Oh, man. Oh, God. Kind of hard. Well, tell you the truth, I can't really tell you my favorite film, because if I tell you my favorite film, I'll have to tell you my favorite films. So I'll tell you my favorite director, and that's Stanley Kubrick. Ooh. And I think my favorite film out of Stanley Kubrick, and I think everybody would say The Shining, but I probably would say either Clockwork Orange or Eyes Wide Shut.
Well, I've seen both. All three I've seen, so those are good choices. I want to go back to when you mentioned Akira Kurosawa. What blew you away from Akira Kurosawa films?
Oh, man, I really love the framing of his films. For example, Throne of Blood. That film was based off of the Shakespearean work, but I really love the framing and the fact that he can really evoke, like, he can bring the camera to show the emotions of the faces. He really focuses a lot on the emotions. That, and of course, on Seven Samurai. I really love the way he uses his camera. It's almost as like you're watching a painting, you know? It really feels like you're watching a painting. Apart from Stanley Kubrick with Barry Lyndon back in 1975, like, Akira Kurosawa, like, you really, a lot of his films, you like watching a painting, and the framing. Actually, when we were doing the film, me and the DP and I, Zach Meyer, we were actually, you know, we wanted to know what the film would look like, and I really knew right away I wanted the film to look like a mashup of the cinematography-wise department. So like a mashup of Akira Kurosawa and the Coen brothers, because especially, and you'll see what I mean when you watch that the kitchen scene between while Junior was sleeping on the table and Roger and Sadie were going that back and forth, the framing, the fact that, you know, you can like three separate sides of the frame, that the right, middle, and the left. I really wanted that exactly to look like that. Because I want, as almost like a homage to Akira Kurosawa, and the way that he doesn't, a lot of times he uses a mixture of framing and the blocking, which I think is very, very intricate in a lot of his films. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, my last question is, if you could rent a movie theater and show any film you wanted to your friends, family, or whoever you wanted, what film would it be?
Melvin Van Peebles' Watermelon Man.
Oh, wow. I've never seen that. I've seen some of Melvin's stuff, but I have not seen that one.
It is really, it's like shockingly hilarious. Well, there's a lot of moments where it's like, you have to keep that in mind that I believe the film was done either in the late 60s or the early 70s, but either way, as far as civil rights, in that time, that film was completely, like, shocking. Like, apart from Sweet Tupac's Badass Song, like, that film was completely, like, was, like, really ground-shaking. I think that was one of his, I think that's either his only big studio film or one of his studio films, but, because all the majority of his projects are indie. But, yeah, that, it really speaks volumes, even to this day. As for the conversation of like race relations, and it's actually very insightful as far as what people really think about each other. I mean, to give you a little backstory, is really I don't want to spoil it for you, but the film is essentially about like a white man who's essentially a bigot who wakes up the next morning a black man for no reason whatsoever explained.
I like it already. So your film is still, I guess, on the film festival circuit, so nobody can see your film then? I can't even tell them where to go?
You can tell them that as long as they're in the Manhattan area, just go to downtown Manhattan so that you can actually see the worldwide premiere at Cutting Room International Film Festival, and that it will be happening on October 21st, and that the film block is Film Block J. And, yeah, it's going to be a big thing. It's going to be actors, actresses there. I believe celebrities as well. Great food and great time. Everybody will just have a great time.
You're going to be there too. That's the whole point. We want to meet you.
Of course, I'll be there as well.
Well, thank you for your time. You were awesome.
All right, thank you for interviewing me. You were a great interviewer.
Thank you so much. Bye bye.
All right, bye.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.